Bell Canada was arguing. Maybe not. Today, we're going to bring you a totally different perspective on how we got to the situation we're in right now. I have looked and discussed again and again at the impact of social media and Google and Facebook on the news business. But the story doesn't begin with those companies. The story of the downfall of Canadian news might begin back in the 90s, when Canadian media companies made a bad, bad bet. And as you're going to hear, when to pay off, down again and again and again. And that debt just got bigger and bigger. And for that debt, the news industry. In other words, it's a setup. In a minute, I'm going to sit down with our reporter, Charisse Sutra, who's going to tell you all about it. Wait for it.
Hey, Jesse.
Hey, Charisse.
So I want to do a little activity here. I want to take a stroll through the Canadian news media graveyard. Do you remember Toronto?
Toronto One.
It lived very briefly. It was envisioned as a Toronto TV station with local programming and content, first owned by Craig Media. Then it was bought by Chum. Then it was bought by Quebecor. Now it exists as Sun News with completely different sort of Fox-style content.
I have vague memories. There's a lot in this media graveyard. It's sort of a necropolis. It's vast.
It really is. Speaking of Chum, do you remember Chum?
Of course I remember Chum.
A beloved network of radio and TV that was pretty iconic for a time. There is still a radio station under the Chum name, but the original Chum network of media was broken up into parts, now owned by different corporations. Are there other things in this graveyard of delights, Jesse?
I mean, Much Music, Grid, Now Magazine is dead. There was something called the Toronto Standard. There was Toronto-ist.
Well, national, we've got, I mean, Vice Canada, W5.
BV.
Bloomberg TV, yeah.
I mean, I really could go on.
We could go on forever. It's a very crowded graveyard we're walking through currently, and really dead yet. Like Much Music, they're still around in name, but they're kind of shadows of their former selves, zombies, basically. At Candleland, we've talked a lot about this before, covering how all of these media companies have lived and died over the years. But, Jesse, I think we may have missed something.
How dare you?
So, not long after major Bell cuts happened in February, I had a source who works in finance, and he reached out and he said, more layoffs at Bell are coming. Not even a week later, Bell laid off 400 workers, and according to their union, this was done through this virtual group meeting where people weren't allowed to say anything. And so I asked my source how he knew this would happen. He told me that Bell and other Canadian media companies had made decisions years ago that's now impacting their balance sheets today, and it's something that investors are concerned about. Jesse, they're in a boatload of debt.
I mean, don't all corporations, even successful corporations, take on debt? That's just a part of being a big corporation.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Every major corporation has a lot of debt, billions and billions of dollars. The problem is that it's old debt from moves that they made way before the downturn of journalism.
What do you mean? What were these moves they made before the bottom fell out of traditional media?
So the answer to that question is kind of like something out of a movie. It's the story of a crazy idea, a little bit of a cultish following, which all ended up going up in flames. So to tell the story, I spoke to Dwayne Wincek. He's a professor at the School of Journalism and the Global Media and Internet Concentration Project.
The idea was that convergence between telecommunication, media, and internet services was going to be the wave of the future. And that, you know, the internet would really be nothing but a bunch of blank gray screens, according to Bronfman, who was heading up Seagram's at the time, Universal Music. And without content, internet companies would basically be dead in the water and people would be left. The look was that companies had to move deeply into the media industries to gain access to the content that would allow the internet to flourish.
So people being unamused by the internet, that was the big danger they were afraid of, that people wouldn't be entertained enough by screens. But during this time, a number of major mergers happened. There was a merger between Disney and ABC, 2004, NBC Universal. But the biggest merger to come out of this period by far was the AOL Time Warner merger in 2000. Do you remember AOL?
I think I probably still have about 100 free CDs that were mailed, that were like, you know, covering the streets during the heyday of America Online.
Back in the 2000s, AOL Time Warner was basically a model after which Canadian media companies copied.
Major industry leaders had kind of stars in their eyes, convergence dreams were running amok. And you saw people like Gene Monty, the CEO of Bell Canada, at the rush down to speak to his counterparts at AOL and Time Warner in New York, Gerald Levin and Stephen Chase. Pierre-Carl Péladeau followed suit there afterwards, and they went to New York kind of on bended knees to listen to the wisdom about convergence, and they brought that home, and they tried to pursue the same dream here in Canada. And this was when into the media series by acquiring CTV in 2000 in the Globe and Mail around the same time. And it was the time to acquire Videotron and TVA and move really from being a newspaper and magazine publisher, the heart of the media and the telecom industry.
I guess if you are a telecom back at the early like birth of the internet and you can't where the people who use it are actually amusing each other and you've got a very mass media mindset about it, then you're thinking, how am I going to get people to the telecom service I provide? I got to get a lot of content on there. People want professional content. And that's why you've got PKP and Bell and all the telecoms rushing to acquire content companies. To me, it seems hilarious now with this like overwhelming ocean of content, the least of which is what is being made by traditional legacy broadcasters. But at the time, if you own internet pipes and you're building internet infrastructure, shit, we got to put some content on there. So let's gobble up local news. And I had never even thought about that.
Yeah. That was the solve for the internet problem that didn't really exist. It makes sense because at the time, they wanted the internet to be successful.
I remember that attitude. I remember that those of us who are sort of like, I don't know, internet grassroots and like, oh, the people's medium, were kind of laughed at by slick media people. Like, oh, like it's stuff like you're saying, like, in the future, everyone's going to read zines that I photocopy. It's like, no, they're not. They're going to watch network television. Thought of as an impossibility. Citizen journalists or independent artists or, you know, like you would get laughed at by Joe Pros. So I do remember that attitude. I never thought of telecoms before.
And there are actually a few reasons why they thought convergence would make sense. One, because they thought advertisers would naturally want to spend more because there were more on. So they were to rake in advertising money. They also thought that by combining radio, newspapers, and TV, it would become more cost-effective because, say, you have a news story you can easily put on all three platforms and not spend as much.
It's easy to laugh at them now, but I also think that to try to see this from their perspective, from where they were standing at the time, this followed a period where media empires, consolidation chains were incredibly profitable, where you went from like newspaper to a chain of newspapers, and then the economies of scale were such that you could kind of like make it a lot more profitable that way. And then if you gobble up a bunch of radio stations as well, and then you get into cable TV. So these major empires, and we remember like the Aspers and all these different people in Canada, that was an effective business model. And I think that it's totally understandable that they would look at the internet and say, that's the next piece.
But as we know, at this point in time, convergence didn't pan out. And that's for a bunch of reasons as well, because A, advertising spending didn't go up. It actually went down because advertisers saw all of these media companies in a package and they thought they should get a deal for Heiser. You know, give me a deal.
Cheaper by the dozen and, you know, kind of a do you want fries with that? Like,
exactly.
Yeah.
The second reason was because combining radio, newspapers, and TV didn't have because they're made differently.
So the idea held by accountants that and engineers, that you could just kind of mush all this together and call it a convergence package, really didn't to the realities on the ground as to what it actually takes to be successful in the cultural industries, which under the best of times are very risky businesses.
These are very different kinds of businesses.
Very much so.
I remember like when it was like, oh, this is going to be great. You'll just send a reporter out. They'll have a camera. They'll make the TV clip. They'll do the radio. They'll also do the print piece. Like, this was going to be the journalist of the future, was going to be like kind of multimedia and also medium agnostic.
Oh, yeah.
And that has never worked. And it's always fallen apart, because what you need to do to get good television is very different than what you need to do to get good audio, is different than what you need. Like, every attempt to find synergies like that has kind of like degraded the product. It's an old story of a big company like Rogers buying a profitable small blog, website, or podcast company, because the way that they do business at that scale doesn't work for a business that was built to operate in a much smaller, more modest way.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if only they had asked the actual creators of these things, what would happen? Anyway.
No respect at all.
No, we get no respect. So media corporations started to realize they'd made a bad bet, and they spent millions and billions making it.
Well, the big poster child of convergence, AOL Time Warner, imploded. And over the next several years, Time Warner tried to kind of reach its footing. So what they were doing was they were really paring back Time Warner to its former glory days in the film. And who was the CEO of Time Warner at the time, is really chastened. And he goes off and spends time in a monastery in California for the next couple of years to try to regain a sense of who he is and in his place in the world after having been completely deluded by the froth and the glitter and gold of money on Wall Street. So very interesting times.
I'm having a vision here of Don Draper at Esalen at the end of Mad Men.
But in Canada, similar things were happening. But anyway, you'd think that in the early 2000s and the failure and the trips to the monasteries, companies would learn their lesson, but it didn't actually work out exactly that way. Acquisitions just that they did, and big companies like Rogers, Bell, Quebecor, they just kept buying and buying up properties.
I did a quick and dirty tally over the last decade of, and it's, you know, starts back in 2011 with the reacquisition of CTV, and they sell out in 2006. 2011, they come rebuying CTV, Canada's largest English language television and radio operations. So that's a $3.2 billion deal. Fast forward to 2013, the Astral deal, biggest private broadcaster in the country, gets scooped up for $3.4 billion. 2017, MTS is a almost $4 billion deal. In Inveronix, 2021, $100 million deal. 2022, we get Ebox and Distributel too. So last point on this, which is just acquisitions and a steady slew of them have led to this debt.
And the ills have the market.
It's not just Bell, though. It's Quebecor. I mean, Quebecor's debt levels are way higher than BCE's, about triple. And Rogers' debt levels are also triple what BCE's already high levels are. And we see Rogers' debt levels double over the last 2 years because of, course, Shaw in this $26 billion deal that, you know, basically consolidates what had previously been Cable Monopoly East and Cable Monopoly West into, you know, National Communications Company. Because what we've got is debt is just an index of a strategy of monopolization or consolidation. And what these folks do is to buy themselves market and buy off rivals to protect existing market share.
All right, so let me try to encapsulate this little history lesson you're giving me here. Following really decades of consolidation and concentration, the building of media empires back from the newspaper media empires, which begat the cable broadcast empires, the powers that be looked at the internet in a very similar way and went on a wave of acquisition that saw them taking on hundreds of millions of dollars of debt. And I'm going to guess that this all happened during a period of time when money was cheap.
And now, debt is no longer cheap. The big bets these media companies made need to be paid off. And everything is about to fall off a cliff. So, Jesse, you're a homeowner. Are you worried about interest?
Very much so. And I remember when we bought our home and we took on like $500,000 of debt, and I think I was making $60,000 a year, and it felt like the riskiest. But all of the advice we were getting was, who cares? This debt is cheap. Get into the market. You'll have a long time to pay this off, and the interest won't be that bad. But a lot of people, here I am now dealing with that debt hasn't really diminished much over the years, and now what it costs to carry it is a lot more than it used to be.
And a lot of people are in that situation right now. And guess who else is in that situation? The great big Canadian media companies.
They're carrying all this debt, and the cost of carrying it might be, maybe I don't need a Netflix subscription. Maybe I don't need a news network.
Exactly. Maybe you don't need a news network after all. So I spoke to a guy named Steve Hyland. He operates a website called thedeepdive.ca, which does a lot of reporting on Canadian stocks and the stock market. And so he explained to me, feeling like we're in.
Now, the reason that debt is suddenly interesting and nobody really cared about it, say, 5 years ago versus today, is that we recently had pop up central and they moved interest rates up very aggressively, the most aggressively we've pretty much seen in our lifetime. And then suddenly we go from near zero interest rates with the central banks to 500 basis points. And that means that all these private companies are now paying closer to 10%. And wow, it's suddenly a big problem.
But now there's another factor to consider here, and that's the shareholders. Shareholders want to be paid out. Hyland says that the dividend Bell pays out, for example, is a cash flow that a lot of investors like pension funds dependent on, almost sacred in Canada.
This is a sacred Canadian institution, this Bell dividend. In simple terms, what a company can do with their profit, invest those profits into growth, or they can say, you know what, we're happy with our level of growth, so let's give those to the shareholders. A lot of retirees, pension fund, that cash flow, they're counting on that dividend.
And if there's no dividend, well, the jobs of executives will be on the line.
So Bell's at a point, though, where I think it was dollars in dividends. So, like, that's a pretty big number when you're trying to figure out how to get your $36 billion in debt down. Like, obviously, like, it would just be like, cut the dividend. But it's going to be a very heated decision for the board, who will probably all largely get voted out and lose their jobs.
I know about this whole, like, Bell is the most solid thing you could possibly invest in. I think her grandparents bought her, like, when she was like 10, like, here, we're buying you like 10 stocks in Bell. She gets these checks first.
Cool.
Right? Like, and it's like clockwork. I'm like, what? Like, sometimes it's like $1.30 or something. And I'm like,
probably cost you more to go to the bank and deposit.
Yeah, it's a pain in the ass. It's like that Seinfeld episode. I'm aware of this mystique around it, and I know why this becomes this sacred thing, because if that's what they're known for, as just this blue chip stock, that not only does Bell go up, but you get paid your dividends and you come to rely on it for your, like, you know, your income post-retirement or something. If that is the aura and allure of Bell, a change to that could send that stock. It's not just about those executives losing their jobs. It could change the way people relate to that stock and put a run on that stock, and people could go running for some other blue chip stock that pays more dependable dividends. So they're going to keep that dividend solid no matter what's happening internally.
Yeah, exactly. It's like they want to keep that reputation of being the Canadian stock to buy. When you look at how the investors in reports and earnings calls, it's this rosy picture of financial growth. They talk about increasing dividends. What a sure bet they are for a smart investor. This is Mirko Bibic, CEO of Bell Canada, in BCE's most recent earnings call.
We're increasing the BCE common share dividend by 3.1% for 2024. It's our 16th year of uninterrupted growth, demonstrating our unwavering commitment to dividend growth. Dividend growth remains, continue to prioritize it in our capital allocation.
And even though Bibic talks about how they've lost $40 million a year on news actually still making money, in 2023, BCE raked in over $2 billion in net earnings from $24 billion in revenue. Because things like internet and phones are profitable. But it's all about growth and keeping this growth up while they can continue to pay down their debt and make sure the company is attractive to them. So they balance out the books. Well, what's a little corporation to do? They start to slash and burn. Dwayne Wincik explained what this means.
Slash and burn is the idea that you basically now have massive amounts of debt that you have to pay back. And so when you're a telecoms company and your mobile wireless operations or your internet access operations are spinning off profits in the high 30%, 40% range, that means that your media operations are expected to perform somewhere close to that. So Slashen says, look, what we're going to do to drive profits up at these units, that like the Bell Media unit, for example, goes to the much more mobile wireless side and the internet access operations, we're going to slash and burn. We're going to cut back on our investment in programming and the number of journals that we employ and so forth. And it's basically a way of retrenching and of trying to make finances work.
The funny thing about slash and burn is they're just reversing what they did initially.
Exactly.
They picked up these little pieces and said it's going to be stronger if it all forms a big Voltron. And then they're like, actually, let's just sell off. Usually after they've like cut them internally and they've stopped making as much money as they used to, then they dump them for like often a fraction of what they paid and leaving them in terrible shape.
Slash and burn is gutting the things that are making less money. That means layoffs, the same layoffs we're seeing now, fit exactly into this sort of slash and burn approach. So remember those Bell jobs that got cut a few weeks ago? Well, I asked Steve Hyland if he thinks they could have been saved.
What's going to happen if they cut that dividend and keep those employees? Well, the shareholders are going to have a board, and they're going to put in a board that's just going to keep that dividend going. That's how capitalism works.
But Charisse, news is no longer profitable. I'm pretty sure that most legacy news is losing money, right?
Well, yes, that might be true. But here's where expectation of profits and the reality need to be looked at. And Wincik talks about the idea that news has always been supported by outside sources.
There's a long hidden truth in the economics of journalism, which is that nobody has ever paid full price of news, of a general news service. It's always been subsidized by one of three things or a combination of three. Advertising, which in Canada ruled 1930s up until about 2005. Wealthy patrons. We heard of Conrad Black coming in the 1990s and buying up Southern as part of an ideological. Wealthy patrons, you know, will basically foot the bill for an ideological project. And then third, there is, of course, governments.
I'm aware of that, Cast, that the larger business for broadcasters of owning a TV station was incredibly profitable, but in order to do that, to be granted property, our airwaves, no, the deal they made with the public via the CRTC was, all right, we're going to make a ton of money off of I Love Lucy and American Network TV, but it's really a license to print money, we're going to do news. And yeah, we'll try to make a buck off of it, but if we lose money off of it, that's okay. We're making so much money off of all this other stuff that this back, and it's got a bit of a brand lift because it gives us sort of a local Canadian presence that we're keeping you informed and we're building up our local personalities. That was the traditional deal. Lost leader, but a lost leader in a very profitable enterprise.
Yeah, and that's actually how Heritage Minister Pascal St-Ange described it in February when she reacted to the layoffs.
I'm extremely disappointed in Bell Canada's decision for many reasons. One of them is because in the past decade, when acquisition were allowed for those big companies to acquire television station or radio station, it came with the promise that they would deliver on news content. Also, the CRTC, because they are facing difficulties, alleviated them of the burden of $40 million a year to keep their promise of producing news. And again, they're backing away from that.
So that deal seems to be broken now.
All of this dumps us out into what we have right now. Where does this leave us? Are we still in the slash and burn era, or can we like kind of move on to figuring out how to rebuild something new?
That's a great question, Jesse. That takes us exactly to where we are now. So I actually have one question for you.
Who I want to be, I'm a survivor.
Have you ever seen the early 2000s sitcom Reba?
No.
You've never seen it. It stars Reba McEntire.
Freeze! What, me? No, the fridge is broken. I'm talking to the peas.
My mom used to watch it. And
so you have seen it.
I mean, I've seen them to watch something different.
Lies, all lies. I know you secretly indulge in Reba. The reason I'm asking is because Steve Hyland actually says that TV is about to be all Reba time.
What on earth are you talking about?
My theory on what will happen to Bell is they're going to package off whatever they can in Bell Media, private equity, who's going to do a mathematical exercise of how do we just turn on the Reba machine or whatever those different sitcoms or Gilmore Girls or whatever, and hope that there's going to be people that are, you know, in their 60s, 70s, and 80s that keep paying for the cable because they've had it their entire lives. That's what they know.
Why, Mom! Oh, that's great, Jackie, your first win! Yeah! How bad was the other team?
They didn't show up.
So hours and hours of the TV show Reba on the floor. And Winsek predicts that news actually isn't totally done for. He thinks it'll become more niche, either that or it all comes shooting down.
There's not a viable business model for the news. There never has been, and there never will be. For specialized kinds of news like this, you will have a paying audience, and they will be able to combination with, you know, subscribers picking up the big share of the bill, maybe a modicum of advertising picking up another, you know, decent-sized chunk, and then wealthy patrons or some kind of public subsidies. You can cobble it together and make the Logic, the Athletic, and I would say Canada Land work, right? But if you talk about it, like, you know, the former network news, they're gone. And unless we decide that through public policy, regulatory measures, public funding, to try to do something about this, there's no cure in sight.
So what do you think is going to happen, Jesse?
I think that there is an interesting conversation that is happening, but I think Canada is getting it wrong in terms of looking at the traditional deal we had with these telecom giants and saying, what do you owe the public? Somehow they are weaseling their way out of any news obligation. Their entire conception of where is media and where it might go and what is possible and ultimately how terrible everything is and how hopeless it is, it was all based on a concept that the only way media can work is at mass media scale. But that does not mean that there is not a future for news media. Maybe it's time for us to